I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we return to the issue of government transparency, this time through the lens of the fight for the release of the JFK records. Donald Trump, of course, infamously pushed for more of the documents to be released, but ultimately the delays have continued. A group of dedicated activists, however, wants that to change. Joining us to discuss his letter to the President, Joe Biden, about ending the delays on the release of these documents is environmental lawyer Larry Schnapf, who has gained support from both ends of the Kennedy assassination debate, which is to say that he has garnered support from people who believe that Oswald did it all on his own and those who believe the assassination of Kennedy was a conspiracy, a coup d'etat that ushered in a whole new form of government. Also joining us is Jacob Hornberger of the Future of Freedom Foundation, who has written extensively about the Kennedy assassination. I'm a bit more of a left-wing guy. Jacob is a libertarian. And Larry is an independent. So this is a sort of cross-partisan conversation, and I hope you will find it enjoyable. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the release of the JFK records, especially considering Joe Biden's executive order calling for a review for the declassification of 9/11 documents. That was big news a few days ago. And now on to the conversation with environmental lawyer Larry Schnapf and the Future of Freedom Foundation's Jacob Hornberger. Welcome to Parallax Views. Larry Schnapf, environmental lawyer, and last minute addition here, sort of last minute, we decided on this a few hours ago, Jacob Hornberger of the Future of Freedom Foundation. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Yeah. Great to be here.
Yes, me too.
So I wanted to have both of you on because, Larry, you've written a letter to President Joe Biden concerning the JFK records. Now, on this show, I've covered the Kennedy assassination, but for me, I've always wanted to cover it from the perspective of we need much more transparency when it comes to our government, especially because I think, as we've seen lately, there is so much polarization in our country. And also, I think there's a lot of distrust in our institutions, and not all of that is unfounded. So for me, this is a big transparency issue, the JFK records. And Larry, I wanted to ask you, first of all, why haven't we got all the records released yet?
You know, the JFK Records Act was, if you want to go back to the beginning, oddly enough, Lee Rankin had classified, he told the National Archives to classify all the Warren Commission records. And that was really an error. It should not have been classified. In fact, when David Bellin, who was a staff attorney for the Warren Commission, testified before Bella Abzug's committee in 1974. He said that they were wrongly classified. In fact, that had put the legal staff, in an uncomfortable position because they were reviewing allegedly records that were classified, and they didn't have any clearance to review classified records. So clearly these records were not originally contemplated as being classified, but they got classified. In the 70s, people like Carol Weisberg and others tried to really get the records released through the Freedom of Information Act. Actually, the FBI was one of the worst agencies to fight back on the release of the records. They were claiming that these were law enforcement records, and of course they weren't doing any law enforcement about the Kennedy assassination. And that actually led to an amendment to the FOIA Act sponsored by Ted Kennedy to narrow that exemption. But the other agency obviously is the CIA, and Jacob has much more more information about why the CIA would want those records classified. And then when the JFK movie came out in 1991, there was such an uproar that Congress passed the JFK Assassination Records Act. And that required, that created a assassination records review board. It ordered the agencies to turn over and form a collection of JFK records to review the records. There was the standards under the JFK Records Act are much more stringent than the standards under the Freedom of Information Act. It doesn't have the same exemptions. And records are to be released unless they pose an identifiable harm to national security. And identifiable harm doesn't mean something that might happen. It has to be a present identifiable harm. The Assassination Review Board reviewed thousands of records, and there was a process if an agency objected to the release of a record, they would object. The ARB would then go into a mediation with them, and if they still decided, ARB still decided to release the records, the agency could then appeal to the president. Unfortunately, while the ARB did a great job in releasing lots of records and actually went a little beyond just releasing records, they actually re-interviewed the doctors and other important players, the ARB had a clock ticking on it. And so at the end, when ARB went out of existence in 1998, there were still thousands of records that had not been released. And so the JFK Act, I don't think Congress contemplated how long this would take and how difficult it would be. But they provided that the records, any records that were not released by the time the ARB went out of business, all records had to be released by October 26, 2017, which is 25 years from the enactment of the JFK Act. Well, we come to October 26, 2017, and President Trump first says he's going to release them, and then he doesn't, and he allows for a six-month extension. Completely nowhere in the statute does it allow for a six-month extension. He doesn't comply with the law, which requires if you're going to postpone, you have to do on a document-by-document basis. You have to identify the harm, the identifiable harm to national security, and explain how that outweighs the very strong public interest in the documents. And there's a strong presumption of disclosure. And this was an orchestrated act. They got an opinion of counsel from the Office of Legal Counsel of the White House to the White House, which is in the Department of Justice. His legal memo, we don't think complied with the law. I think he basically interpreted the law in a different way, but he was being asked to provide for a legal argument to justify the position. So then the president says, you have six more months to release the records. And then in April of 2018, the archivist, presumably at the request of the president, then says recommendations to the White House saying that we recommend an additional 3.5 years for the records to be released. And then the president issues another order in April 26th of 2018, further postponing the records until this year. And from the start of this year, I've put together a bunch of lawyers, and we've been writing letters first to Congress. We have a graduated program we're doing. So first he wrote letters to Congress. We also contacted the Public Interest Declassification Board, which is supposed to, it's tasked with making recommendations to the president about declassification. And we had the JFK Records Act be placed on their agenda for their May meeting. And they are supposedly working with the archives this summer to process requests from the agencies. We know that the agencies have already asked for further postponement. And then the under the Trump order, the archivist is supposed to provide recommendations to the president by September 26th of this month. And then the president has a month to render an opinion, a decision on those requests and issue a decision in October 26th. We know that there's been a request for further postponements through our back channel discussions. We also know that National Archives is very interested in getting this behind them. They don't want to have to deal with this anymore. But because of COVID, they've also had restricted ability to review records. So I suspect we're not going to get a complete release. We've been in discussions with some people at the White House, and they've asked us for a priority list of documents, which I'm sure Jacob would agree. You know, you look at that two ways. This is a good faith ask by people who have not been previously involved in this process, or is this a way to flesh out what the really important documents are to make sure they won't release?
How would you determine what the priority documents are? And then I want to kick it over to Jacob, but could you answer that question first?
We actually are. We have some people that are looking into that. Jeff Morley and Rex Bradford are working with Bill Simpich and also Malcolm Blunt. And we're coming up. Actually, we have our preliminary list. We're going to finalize it next week. And then we will communicate that list to the White House. And then after 9/11, we're going to kick off a media campaign to put pressure on the White House and Congress. The letter I sent to Congress, both the House and the Senate in spring, was to hold oversight hearings. Congress has continuing obligations to conduct oversight and compliance with the law. So we're going to try to see if we can get Congress to do some oversight, maybe looking at this in terms of a form of kind of like infrastructure, like does NARA need more resources to get this work done? And then, we are going to be asking people to call the White House and Congress. So we have some experts that are going to be coming up with our wish list of very important documents that we think need to be released immediately.
So I want to kick this over to Jacob. I was mentioning earlier, I mean, I'm sort of a, you know, I'm politically to the left of the center. You're more a libertarian, but I think we can all sort of come together on this issue of releasing the documents. And I even think that people who are skeptical of the conspiracies around the Kennedy assassination, I think they can even come together on this, because for me, it's an issue of government transparency and, you know, renewing trust in our institutions, which are at an all-time low. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on this, that is this a transparency issue?
Well, it partly is, but it's also a way to cover up criminal conduct. Look, if you've committed a crime and there are records that provide circumstantial evidence of the commission of that crime, you're going to want to delay the release of those records as long as you can, possibly forever. The very notion that the release of 50, 60-year-old records is some kind of threat to national security, whatever definition you want to put onto that nebulous, ridiculous term, is ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. You can release every one of those records, and the United States is not going to fall into the ocean. They're not going to be taken over by the communists. Cuba's not going to invade the United States. Look, what happened was after Oliver Stone's movie, JFK came out, and it forced people put pressure on Congress to enact this law. And this whole assassination was shrouded in secrecy. Now ask yourself, why would you shroud this whole thing in secrecy if a lone nut communist ex-Marine really did this? What does that have to do with national security if it's really just a lone nut that happens to be at the right place at the right time? Well, once the ARRB, the Assassination Records Review Board, comes into existence, they forced the release of all the medical records, which they had kept secret for 30 years. They had sworn all the people involved in the autopsy, which was conducted just a few hours after the assassination by the National Security Establishment, by the military. They'd sworn everybody to secrecy. They threatened them. If you ever talk about what you saw here, we will come after you with all guns blaring, court martial, prosecution. They put the fear of God in them.
Not to interrupt you, but wasn't there an issue with that? I think they were going to do the autopsy in Texas, and then they ended up doing it in D.C., or wasn't there an issue there or no?
Absolutely. This turned out to be a fraudulent autopsy, and that's the mountain of evidence that came out in the 1990s, establishing a fraudulent autopsy. Well, there's no innocent explanation for a fraudulent autopsy. It's automatically built into the assassination, and this is one undisputed fact. In the entire assassination, it was the military and the National Security Establishment that conducted the autopsy. Well, Texas law required the medical examiner in Dallas to conduct the autopsy. Now, the autopsy is going to determine what is the cause of death here. Well, so Dr. Earl Rose says, I'm going to conduct this autopsy. A team of Secret Service agents, led by Roy Kellerman, who was in the passenger seat of the limousine, who stood there like a bump on the log when the first shot went on. He didn't jump in the back and cover the president like he was supposed to. He leads this team brandishing guns and says, you're not going to conduct this autopsy. We're not going to let you. And they forced their way out of Parkland Hospital. Lyndon Johnson's waiting for the casket. They're already removing seats from Air Force One. Johnson takes it to Maryland and delivers it into the hands of the military. So what happened in the 90s is when they got the release of these records, as Larry alluded to, there's doctors' testimony was taken, records, people popped up and disclosed things that had been kept secret for 30 years. It established without a doubt the fraudulent autopsy that had been conducted. Well, now what's in the rest of these records? We don't know. I mean, it's hard to say what should have priority, because when you don't know what's in there, how do you establish priority? But right. My hunch is that a lot of those records deal with Oswald's supposed trip to Mexico City, where the National Security Establishment was establishing Oswald as a genuine communist, supposedly leading him into the Soviet embassy and the Cuban embassy. That thing went totally awry, and it's still shrouded in secrecy. And my hunch is that after they saw what happened with the autopsy records, they realized, we can't let this happen again. We've got to keep these records secret for the next 100 years. And I think it's primarily relating to Mexico City, because, like I say, everything went to pieces on that part of the operation.
I think it's also probably New Orleans, because that's where he started his fake cover as a pro-Castro person, when he probably was actually infiltrating trying to figure out who the Castro agents were, infiltrating the anti-Castro Cubans. You know, I think that it's probably north, because a lot of the documents that are held back are the Joannidis, the records related to him. And he was in charge. He was the contact for the DRE, that was the Cuban exile students, the group. So I think between Mexico City and New Orleans is where Oswald's, you know, connections probably would maybe release. But Jacob's perfectly right. I mean, how do you ask for a priority of documents when you don't know what's actually all there? I mean, we're focusing on documents now that have, you know, numbers, the RIF numbers, the record identification numbers attached to them. But there's plenty of missing records that church committee records. There are still records. Bobby Kennedy, when he learned that his brother was killed, he had Mrs. Lincoln go into the White House and take all the tapes relating to Cuba from 1963 and a lot of files. And they're sitting in the Bobby Kennedy Trust, and they have not been released. So, you know, there's a lot of documents out there that we have no idea. They don't have numbers attached to them. We don't know what they are.
Yeah, let me add something, because Larry makes a very good point that you've got records relating to the operation part of it in New Orleans, George Joannidis. But this is one of the other reasons why they don't want to release all the records. Because once you release the records, then you can determine what they haven't released, what they're still hiding. I mean, for example, this George Ioannidis connection, and they've been Jefferson Morley, who is an assassination researcher, he filed suit against the CIA. We've published a book on this at the Future of Freedom Foundation, where I serve as president, called Morley versus the CIA. They fought him fiercely.
I just had him on about that, actually, Jefferson. So go on.
Well, then you know about it. So they fought fiercely to keep these records secret. Are these part of the records that are still yet to be released? We don't know that. Theoretically, they could be. But once all the records are released, then we can determine for sure that they're still hiding the Ioannidis records.
Like, for example, there are records from the Church Committee where in footnotes they reference documents that they're not in the collection. So clearly, so that's when you read through the stuff, you look at the footnotes and say, well, where's this document? And it hasn't been released and hasn't even been identified.
So, Larry, I know we were talking before we came on air about there's a cross-section of support for the letter that has been given to Joe Biden. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we're making this a transparency issue. I think there's widespread agreement that we have a problem of overclassification in this country. And so and we were warned that, for example, with the Public Interest Declassification Board, they are afraid of touching the Kennedy case. So what we did was we said, this is all about compliance. This is not about whose theory is right. This is about getting the records released, complying with the JFK Records Act. So to drive that point home, the signatories, and Jacob's one of the signatories, the signatories include supporters of the Warren Commission, the official findings. So it's what I would call like a bipartisan page. We have Larry Sabato on there. We have Posner on there, Gene Davidson. We have people that, you know, support the Warren Commission and the House Select Assassination Committee findings, in addition to people that believe that there was a conspiracy. The idea is that this is about compliance with the law. Congress wanted the records to be released. The agencies have not complied with both the spirit and the letter of the law. And we're asking President Biden to order the agencies now to release everything. And both sides, why would a person that supports the Warren Commission support this letter? Because they believe that when all the records are released, it's gonna support their view. Interestingly, obviously Vincent Bulugosi is dead. There have been 7 mock trials that have been held since 1967 that have been sponsored by either law schools or bar associations. 6 of those 7 mock trials have resulted in an acquittal or a hung jury. The only one that went to a conviction was the one Vincent Bulugosi did against Jerry Spence. Jerry Spence, by all measures, was not prepared and tried to do courtroom antics instead of dealing with the evidence. But when you look at Vincent Bulugosi's book on page 987, that tells you what animates the lone gunman supporters, because he says on those pages, 986, 987, 988, that what would it mean if this country had a conspiracy to kill the president? It would mean that we're no better than the Europeans and that our institutions are just like a third world country. This is about American exceptionalism and false patriotism. This is what they're feeling. Now, Jacob has other evidence to suggest that it goes beyond that. But I'm just saying, just from a, why are mainstream people, supporting the Warren Commission? I can tell you that when I interviewed Alec Baldwin for our Kappa mock trial, he told a story about how he was prevented from putting on a show about the Kennedy assassination. He was told it was the policy of the NBC network to support the Warren Commission. So, the media is in on this as well.
I just wanted to add to that, too, since we mentioned Bugliosi. I know that Bugliosi was supporting Jefferson Morley's efforts to get documents released. So, I mean, even Bugliosi wanted documents released before he passed away.
He believes at the end of the day, that there would be nothing there to show anything but that Oswald was a lone gunman. Obviously, there's not going to be a letter saying, let's put Oswald on the sixth floor and have him shoot the president. You know, there's never going to be a smoking gun. But I think there'll be documents, as Jacob suggested, that you can get inferences. And, you know, there's a bureaucratic way of writing memos. And if you're familiar with that way, then you can glean, you read between the lines and you can see what they're really saying. So it's going to, once the records come out, there'll be a time for people to study them, historians and researchers. I don't think we're going to get a full release in October, if nothing else, because they're going to rely on COVID as having cut down their resources. But today the president issued a presidential executive order ordering certain releases of or declassification of certain records associated with 9/11. We're hopeful that this is the first step, and maybe he'll do the same thing with the Kennedy assassination.
So I wanted to kick this over to Jacob. Is there anything you want to add to anything that Larry has said thus far?
No, I think he's encapsulated it well, that there's both sides want the records released, those that believe in the crazy lone nut theory, and those that believe that this was a regime change operation. I believe that as the circumstantial evidence, I think Larry makes a good point. You're not going to find a confession in here. I mean, from the very beginning, the policy of the CIA with respect to their power to conduct state-sponsored assassinations has always been never put any assassination into writing, no reference at all. So you're not going to find anything like that. And when you're dealing with a murder case, people don't talk in murder cases. Like Jimmy Hoffa was murdered, Johnny Rosselli, who was a figure in the Kennedy assassination, he was murdered, nobody ever talked. Where they talked was with, like I said earlier, with respect to the autopsy. And I'm convinced that these records provide these threads or pieces of the puzzle that fill out the mosaic. Like, right. Like Larry points out, in New Orleans, they were establishing Oswald's communist bona fides. Oswald was working for a right wing owned coffee company. I mean, what right winger is going to hire a guy who is supposed communist? It's ridiculous. And then you've got the Mexico City operation where they were trying to establish even further his connections to the Soviet Union and Cuba. They can't afford to have these records come out. I mean, I happen to believe that the fix is in. I mean, I'm cynical. I don't think these records are going to be released, despite the fact that it's almost been 60 years. I think Biden's going to grant another extension. I don't think people are ever going to see these remaining records. I think the reason is they're incriminating.
So we are prepared to file a lawsuit after the president makes his decision. It's a long shot, but we have different grounds that we've come up with than the grounds that have been used in the past under the Freedom of Information Act. We just about finished. We finished our research, and we're gonna start working on our memos, and we're gonna probably file it in the Ninth Circuit because they have a history there of, they were dubious of President Trump's executive orders, and we're trying to couch this. This is like just any other executive action that was challenged the last 4 years. This did not comply with the law, and we're going to ask for an order from the. If we don't get one from the president, we're going to go to court.
I actually wanted to hit upon that because I know Mark Adamczyk at Kennedy's and King has written about the legal issue here, and I guess. Trump's executive order was based on an erroneous and a potentially illegal reading of the JFK Records Act. Is that correct?
His order did not comply with the requirements of the law. It was based on a legal opinion that I don't think it was erroneous. I think it was, you know, when you're a lawyer and you're asked to come up with a conclusion, you write a memo using your best arguments. And that's what he was tasked to do, was to support a postponement. And he used language that did not even appear in a statute. I believe that memo, if that was in court, that memo would be rejected as it read into the law things that didn't happen, that were not there. So Mark's on our team, by the way. He's one of our one member of our lawyer group. The order, we believe that the president's order did not comply with the law.
So I want to kick this back to Jacob, and just to play devil's advocate here, the thing I always hear when it comes to the Kennedy assassination is, you know, even with the regime change operations we've done overseas, you know, the president has to sign off on that. There's no way elements of our national security establishment would actually assassinate the president. How would you respond to that? And have there been instances where the national security establishment has actually tried to deceive the president or go over his head?
How about last week?
Well, what if a president really was a threat to national security? I mean, what if he was selling out to the Russians? I mean, we saw that happen with the Russia connection with, you know, supposed connection with Trump, that where they were saying, oh, well, he's got this connection. They were spying on Trump, keeping track of him. They were convinced. Now, let's just assume for a second that a president is engaged in policies that are going to take the country down and that the CIA and the Pentagon reached that conclusion. 100%. They're convinced that if the president remains in, the country's going to go down. My hunch is that a lot of people would say it's their job. It's their job. Now, the parallel to this is their job is to remove the president, save the country, even though the Constitution doesn't provide that as a means for removing the president. Now, the parallel for this is what happened 10 years after the Kennedy assassination. You've got Salvador Allende, who is democratically elected president of Chile. His policies are much like Kennedy's, very leftist, socialist type, Medicare, and so forth, social welfare programs. But most of all, he said, I have no beef with the Soviet Union in Cuba. I'm going to establish friendly relations with them. Well, the U.S. national security establishment says that can't happen, that not only is he a threat to our national security, this man, Salvador Allende, he is a threat to your national security. And the head of the commanding general of the Chilean Armed Forces says, we're not going down this road. Our Constitution doesn't permit that. So the CIA orchestrates his kidnapping where he gets killed, murdered. So they convince the military, and this is critical. The CIA and the Pentagon convinced the Chilean military, you have a duty to remove your own president. You have a moral duty. It may not be technically legal, but if you don't do this, your country's going down to communism. That's exactly the mindset that took place with respect to Kennedy.
Go ahead, Jacob. I'll finish, and I have some.
Well, if you look at Kennedy's peace speech at American University in June of 63, it is clear that he is leading America in a different direction. He's achieved a breakthrough. He realizes the Cold War is a bunch of bull. It's a racket. And he says the Cold War is over. We're going to get along with the Soviets. Just exactly what Allende would do 10 years later that got him killed. And we're going to move America in a different direction. He had already said he's going to tear the CIA into 1,000 pieces, which means he's going to abolish the CIA. He was at war with the national security establishment over the future direction of this country. And somebody was going to win this war and somebody was going to lose it. And Kennedy, unfortunately, ended up losing the war. The national security establishment did this regime change operation just like they did one 10 years later, just like they did in 53 with Iran, 54 in Guatemala, all with the notion we have a duty to protect national security from all threats, both foreign and domestic, not just the foreign ones, the domestic ones as well.
So remember, when these people take office, they don't take an oath to support the president. They take an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution. Right? It's not personal. It's to the Constitution. So that is what Jacob is sort of alluring to, their obligation, their duty. Now, we also have to look at the personalities who were in the senior levels of management in those days. They really believed that they had as much a right in developing foreign policy as the president. They viewed themselves as co-equals to the president. When you look at
some of them, I think even viewed Kennedy as too soft on communism.
Well, like I'm saying, but the idea is that it isn't like they were serving at the pleasure of the president. When you look at the biographies of the people that were head of the CIA and the national security apparatus in those days, they truly felt that they had as much right to promulgate and develop foreign policy as the president. They viewed themselves as equals to the president. And I could see, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me, honestly, to believe, you know, my gut feeling. I know what Jacob's saying. As a patriotic American, I find it hard to see a man sitting in the White House across from a president and saying, I have to take this man out. It's just hard for me to accept that, you know? But if you believe that this man is taking down the country down a path, he's likely to win re-election. And this path is going to jeopardize our constitutional form of government, our very nation. You might as a last desperate means. Now, that's different from what LBJ. You know, LBJ had an ability. People think he did it, right? If he really wanted to get rid of Kennedy, he could have just had his buddy Hoover release all the dirt he had in Kennedy. That would have prevented Kennedy from winning re-election in 64 with the womanizing and stuff. But the other thing we talked about before we got on recorded was, why is this still relevant to today? And, you know, when Jacob and I, the Kennedy assassination to your generation is sort of what World War I was to Jacob and my generation. It was a long time ago, right? But look at what's happened in the 21st century. We had information that was cobbled together to justify a war in Iraq. Somehow
they're working on Iran, though. They're working on it.
We had this botched planning with Afghanistan. You can go, the weapons of mass destruction didn't exist, right? This allegedly they existed. You can go back to Iran-Contra. You can go back to, Vietnam. I mean, there is a history of a certain part of the government lying to the rest of the government and getting away with it.
Well, I mean, just look at 9/11, and I'm not even getting into the truther stuff, but we talked about the Saudi stuff, this lawsuit with the victims' families. You know, how long did it take us to even get those 28 pages from the Senate Select Committee investigation into the intelligence inquiries around 9/11? You know, this whole national security state thinks it's entitled to keeping all the information to themselves and keeping the truth from us.
I will tell you, even as an environmental lawyer, right, I every day encounter refusals to disclose information because it embarrasses the person, the agency. They destroy emails as soon as the person leaves the agency. They can choose what records are to be considered official government. So even on such minor things as just, it's embarrassing, right? They will over-classify or destroy records. Can you imagine about something that Jacob is talking about? I mean, and anyone that possibly, let's assume it's not as bad as what Jacob said. Let's assume it was a bunch of exiles who were being ostensibly run by the CIA, but they were, because of plausible deniability, they were loosely run. And let's say that they're the ones that killed the president.
You mean like Cuban exiles or something?
Yeah, yeah. Anybody that was involved in supervising, funding them, they would have been so embarrassed that they would also cover that up. So it's just the instinct of any bureaucrat to avoid getting in trouble. And they're going to hide records, overclassify things just because that's the way they are. And then you have on top of that, something as, I mean, taking down a president. I mean, so, but getting back to where what we're trying to do is, at least for the president, and because we know there are people that within the government who are decision makers that are so loath to go touch what they call the Kennedy black hole, a rabbit hole. That's why we are saying this is only about compliance. We just want the records released, and wherever they fall, they fall. There still may be, I can't imagine, but there might be one or two or three records, perhaps, that still implicate national security. Perhaps it's some family of someone that served as a spy for the country, and maybe their lives would be at risk if their name. But then my answer to that is, and just redact their names then, just but still release the document. But I can't imagine that their identifiable harm. It has to be harm that is so, it is real and present, not potential, and it has to still outweigh the strong public interest in disclosure. And they have never explained in any of the postponements how they did that balancing act. And they're required document by document. Trump just broad stroke proposed all these records for further postponement.
So I had one more question for you, Larry. And then first, though, I want to ask Jacob. I don't know if either of you are familiar. There's a really interesting book, not about the assassination itself, but about the president being deceived by the national security establishment. It's called JFK and Vietnam by John Newman. And I was really surprised by it because, I mean, it got accolades from Arthur Schlesinger and James K. Galbraith. So this was not any kind of funny business. This was a very serious book. And it does seem like there was this conflict between the national security apparatus and JFK. Do you know much about that sort of conflict that went on, Jacob?
Absolutely. And that is a watershed book. We had John Newman speak at a recent conference that we had at the Future of Freedom Foundation on the national security state and the Kennedy assassination. And I would invite people to see that the video. It's at fff.org. John is a true scholar. And this was a watershed book. You see, the common perception among the historians was that Johnson just was continuing Kennedy's policies in Vietnam when he took over. And Newman discloses the truth about this, that once Kennedy, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, achieves this breakthrough and realizes that the Cold War is just a racket, and it's a very deadly and dangerous racket. He had come within inches of all-out nuclear war, of Armageddon. And so he says, I'm going to call it off. Well, the war had already started between Kennedy and the CIA back at the Bay of Pigs, where the CIA had lied to him and said, we won't need any air support. And then when the invasion started to falter, they said, well, we need that air support after all. And the reason is that they figured that no president's going to be able to not give the air support because he's not going to be able to withstand the public pressure of letting the communists defeat American exiles. Well, Kennedy said, to heck with you. I told you there would be no air support. You told me it wouldn't be necessary. So the war started with the CIA right there. Kennedy fires Alan Dulles, who was the much revered head of the CIA. It's along with his chief deputy. He's reputed to have said, I'm going to tear the CIA into 1,000 pieces. Their anger and enmity was to him was just as equal. They said that he was a coward, weak on communism. And then, when Kennedy achieves this breakthrough, he, as Newman documents, he starts to pull troops out of Vietnam. And he pulls out 1,000. He had sent in advisors. He said, never will we send in combat troops. But he had sent in advisors after being pressured to do so by the Pentagon and the CIA. He issues an executive order saying, pull out 1,000. And then he tells aides, as soon as I get reelected in 64, I got to wait there because Goldwater will say I'm soft on communism. I'm going to pull them all out. And so here he's at war with the national security establishment. We've published at the Future of Freedom Foundation the finest book in this area. It's called JFK War with the National Security Establishment by Douglas Horn, who served on the Assassination Records Review Board. There was absolutely a fierce war. It was over the future direction of America. And the gauntlet was thrown down at that peace speech in June of 63. When Kennedy said, it's over. I mean, he really threw the gauntlet down. He did not consult with the CIA, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He surprised them with this speech and said, the Cold War is now over. We're going to reach a peaceful coexistence with the Soviet Union, which, of course, would throw into whole question the ever-increasing budgets that would go on with the national security establishment. And then we're still seeing there's a straight line from Afghanistan, this debacle that was based on lies, and Iraq, all the way back to the Kennedy assassination, because if Kennedy had won the war, all of this would have been dismantled.
Now, the answer I always get to what you're saying, and I've had people who are pro-Warren Commission on this show. The last one I had was Fred Litwin, and he said, well, you know, while it may be true that he talked about getting us out of Vietnam and all this stuff, you know, we didn't live to see him do that. He didn't live for us to see him do that. How do you respond to people that say that?
Well, because we can see what his actions and what his words were. He pulls out 1,000 troops and then he tells aides, I'm going to pull them all out. Now, remember, Kennedy was way far ahead of the curve here. He was further in front of the curve than even people today. I mean, this is how far advanced it was. He was in his thinking. He was challenging the Cold War paradigm. How many conservatives today and even liberals challenged the whole Cold War to say the Cold War was a racket? It was a bunch of bull. So Kennedy's running for re-election. He's got to play politics. If he pulls all the troops out, you know what Goldwater's going to say. The communists are coming to get us now. They're going to take us over. This man's soft on communism. That was what the 60 election was all about. You know, who was going to be tougher on Cuba, a country that had never even attacked the United States? So Kennedy's playing politics, but he tells close aides, you need to get me reelected, because that's then when I'm going to pull all the troops back. And the Pentagon and the CIA, they knew exactly where he stood now, that he was going to move America in a totally different direction. And that's what that peace speech was all about.
Here's another example of Kennedy's change in direction. We know that at the day that Kennedy was killed, there was a representative from him speaking to Castro. So when Lisa Howard, who's the first daytime female reporter, interviewed Fidel Castro in May of 63, he had been very frustrated with the way the Russians had handled the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he said he was willing to explore normalization of relations with the United States. She contacted the White House. The CIA was against this idea. She continues to pursue this. And in September, she has a party at her apartment. And she has William Atwood, who is an envoy to the UN, the president, and one of Castro's closest advisors, Luego, I think his name was. And they talk in a corner of her apartment. And Atwood then relays the same message to the president. In November, the president learns that Jean Daniel, a French reporter, is going to be seeing Castro. He then has Jean Daniel come to the White House, and he gives a message to Jean Daniel to give to Castro. And part of the message is that he acknowledges all the things this country has done against Cuba. Castro is so Jean Daniel goes down to Cuba the night before the assassination. They're up till the wee hours of the morning talking. Castro is just fascinated by this. They're having lunch at Castro's, I guess his summer house or whatever, when Castro gets the call about Kennedy. And when
Kennedy had been assassinated.
Right. And he turns to Jean Daniel and says, your peace mission is now over. And Castro predicts that they're going to blame it on a lone person it's the right wing that did this. They're going to blame it on a lone nut. And he actually goes ahead and does his own investigation and says there's no way that someone could have killed the president in the way that was happened with this rifle. But I would suspect that the members of the CIA, when they heard about this back channel, they told the exiles that this was going on. And to them, that was strike three. Strike one was the Bay of Pigs. Strike two was the missile crisis when Kennedy did not invade Cuba. And this was strike three. So that's another example of Kennedy taking us in a different policy direction. So you just don't have Vietnam. He was re-examining our foreign policy.
Yeah, and Khrushchev was on the same page. You see, they were engaged in a secret personal communications between themselves. Khrushchev had reached the same thing. So when Larry talks about ending this war against Cuba, we're talking about lifting the embargo, which is still existing today. Imagine how the CIA and the Pentagon react to this when they learn about it. All this was secret, but they clearly knew about it. They were tapping the phone lines of the Cubans at the United Nations. Imagine their reaction that a president is reaching out in a spirit of peaceful cooperation with the Soviets and the Cubans. The Cold War is going to be over. Imagine their reaction to this.
And when you read Fitzgerald, who was running the operation for Cuba, even though LBJ told him to shut down any of these efforts to invade Cuba or assassinate Castro, he told him that in December. Every month, or virtually every month, from January of 64 through into 1965, they kept pushing this issue. There are memos that you could see that they are trying to push this assassination of Castro. So, you know, you can just see that they were, this was their foreign policy, and President Kennedy was going against their foreign policy.
Well, and let me add something to what Larry alluded to earlier, is that the CIA felt he was in charge of this whole thing. They looked at Kennedy as a neophyte, naive, womanizer, playboy. They didn't know what he was doing. And so, like during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the national security establishment was running operations in Cuba without Kennedy's consent or knowledge, which could have led to a nuclear trigger. And then these assassination plots against Castro, the CIA's always said, oh, well, the Kennedy brothers approved these. That's absolutely nonsense. That the president made it very clear he was against state-sponsored assassinations. Bobby Kennedy made it clear when he became aware of it that they had partnered with the mafia. I mean, Kennedy was prosecuting the mafia. Here, the CIA is on its own establishing an assassination partnership with the mafia. Why? Because they looked at the Kennedys as neophytes, that they knew what's best for what this country is. And that's what the war was all about.
Jacob, didn't, when RFK had that back channel with the Russians for the Cuban Missile Crisis, didn't he tell the Russian that President Kennedy was concerned he was about to lose control of his government?
Absolutely.
He only had a couple more days or else they were going to just. And Khrushchev had the same problem. And you notice
absolutely.
Khrushchev was ousted within 9 months of Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah. Now, Bobby Kennedy was very serious. He had this back channel to the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin. They were friends. And he told Dobrynin at the height of the crisis, if we're going to strike a deal, you need to tell Khrushchev, if we're going to strike a deal, we need to strike it now, because my brother's in grave danger of being taken over by the military, because they didn't like what he was doing. They didn't like his quarantine. They thought it was weak. They wanted him to bomb Cuba. They were pressuring him to bomb Cuba. And it came that close to a military takeover where Kennedy would be ousted in the midst of this crisis because they thought he was weak, that he was making these bad decisions. That's what Bobby Kennedy communicated very seriously to the Soviet ambassador. And at that point, when Khrushchev hears this, Khrushchev freaks out and says, because he understood the danger, because he was facing the same danger in his country from his national security establishment. He said, strike a deal right now. And that's when Kennedy him struck a deal. You get the missiles out. We promise we won't invade you. And then as part of the extra little addendum to him, Kennedy promised to remove nuclear missiles out of Turkey as long as he would be doing it secretly. But this shows you the tension that was going on. Now, here's another factor. There's a great movie called 7 Days in May that is about a military takeover here in the United States, a coup. The same thing that we're talking about here. Kennedy was instrumental in having that movie made as a warning to the American people. This is what we're dealing with now that this government is a national security establishment. It was the same warning that Eisenhower gave in his farewell address about the dangers of this military industrial complex to our liberties, to our democratic processes. Keep in mind, JG, is that you go by, JG?
Yes. Yeah. And just real quick, I was going to add, you can even go back farther than that. There was the whole Wall Street push that General Smedley Butler talked about.
Well, the important thing to keep in mind is that our founding governmental system was a limited government republic with no CIA, no big military establishment, no NSA. If you had told the American people in 1791 that the Constitution was going to bring into existence a national security state, they would have laughed. They would have rejected the deal. They would have continued operating under the Articles of Confederation, where the federal government didn't even have the power to tax.
They didn't even want a standing army.
They opposed standing armies for this very reason that we're talking about. And so throughout the 19th century, there was just a basic, small, relatively small military force. They never would have supported this national security state type of governmental system. North Korea is a national security state. Red China is a national security state. Cuba is a national security state. And so is the United States. And that's what we need to do. That's the lesson of the Kennedy assassination, not to bring people to justice. Everybody's dead that was involved in this. It's to re-examine this governmental structure. Why do we still have a national security state? Why aren't we entitled to the restoration of our limited government republic?
And also, why aren't we entitled to, you know, transparency over secrecy? Before we close out, I also wanted to mention, I don't have like, I'm not a Kennedy assassination expert. I think, Jacob, you've spent a lot of time on the Kennedy assassination. But one thing that has always spooked me about the assassination is when you look at the Nixon tapes, and there's that line where I think Nixon says, you know, the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, that Nixon was under siege and the CIA was not coming to his defense. And so he alluded to that, if you don't come to my defense, I might have to release the truth about the Bay of Pigs. And people have
off the scab of the Bay of Pigs. Yeah.
Yeah. And people think that what he was really saying, I'm going to lift off the secrecy on the Kennedy assassination. Now, that the Bay of Pigs was like a code term for the Kennedy assassination.
Now, Haldeman said that in his book. I confronted John Dean when he, believe it or not, John Dean in the mid-teens was going around the country giving ethics, CLE credits in ethics, giving speeches to law firms, making money, giving ethics speeches. And so I asked him about this in the book, and he says, no, that was a mistake by his co-author, and that Haldeman disavowed that comment. But I have looked and I've not found any official statement by Haldeman anywhere where he takes that back.
You know, I've actually had John Dean on the show before. So maybe if I ever have him on again, I'll ask him about that. But
yes. So, but yeah, you know, and then another thing for Litwin, the missile crisis really changed John Kennedy. When they got that close to World War III, that's what made him realize we can't let this happen again. And the speech in June, this is all a direct, it was that confrontation which completely changed. John Kennedy came into office as a cold warrior, right? He was gonna outrighted Nixon. But that experience seared in him that they have to stop this madness. Now, granted, he did have because of the mixed, the split Congress, and there was a very close election, he did have to play both ends against the middle. The Kennedy boys did kind of like, they can't like go too far one direction. So why he was waiting until 65 to officially pull out, right, of Vietnam. Because if he said beforehand, as Jacob said, he was going to get hammered by the conservatives or by the Republicans.
So, Larry, I wanted to ask you as well, do you think that the 9/11 victims' families' efforts to get information released about the Saudi connection to 9/11, is that a game changer maybe for other people like JFK records activists?
Well, you know, I'm an optimistic person by nature. I am hopeful that this is an indication of how President Biden's gonna look to our request for the Kennedy release of the Kennedy records. But obviously there's a different interest group that's pressuring him to keep the records and the Kennedy assassination classified as opposed to the 9/11. So we hope this serves as precedent and hope that it's showing that, you know, one of his first things he said, and it's in a letter, you know, that what he wants his government to stand for. We're hoping that this is a sign that he'll do the same thing for Kennedy. But I think Jacob is probably right to be cynical. I'm hoping, because I'm so involved with this right now, and I'm just hoping that this is a sign that there's going to be a thaw. And I, you know, it may not, that order is for 6 months. So maybe he'll do the similar thing with the Kennedy records. But I, you know, again, it's different forces pushing back.
So last question here, and it just popped up in my head, and I think Jacob would be well equipped to answer this. You know, when we're talking about the president versus the national security state, do you think there may be parallels today? I mean, I know there's a lot of things we can criticize Biden for, but I'm actually have to be honest, I'm happy with the withdrawal. And it seems like a lot of the national security state is not happy with the withdrawal in Afghanistan. Do you think the wars between the president and the national security establishment continue onward?
Yeah, that is an absolutely fascinating question. And I haven't figured out the answer to that too. That there's a great book called Double Government by Michael Glennon, who is a professor of law at Tufts University and served as legal counsel, I think it was for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he says, look, his thesis is the Pentagon, the CIA, and the NSA, they're really in charge of the federal government, but that's where the real power is. And they permit the other three branches to have the veneer of power. But the real power lies with these people. They're the ones running the show, at least on foreign policy. So could this have happened without the consent of the Pentagon, the CIA? I don't think so. I don't think that Biden is powerful enough to buck them. My hunch is that they had finally come to the end of their rope. They knew that it was inevitable that they were going to lose this war. And they had delayed for the last 6-7 years, the inevitable. And my hunch is they were on board of this thing. Now, there may be some carping among members of the national security establishment, the defense contractors. I mean, there's always going to be this Monday morning military quarterbacking of, oh, he should have done this and he should have done that. But my hunch is that Biden would not have bucked them. If they had said stay, I think Biden would have stayed. I think they were ready to get out as well.
There, I would say, you know, there is a permanent government in Washington and a government that's the public that is appointed. And the permanent, I had this all the time with environmental law. You know, the president changes, and if he's taking the country in a different direction environmentally, then everyone that's against that just slow walks everything, right? And I think that they just slow walk this pullout, and they're making him pay for a decision they don't agree with.
And I'll get in trouble for saying this, but, you know, as much as the term the deep state has now come to be associated with things I think are, you know, pretty ridiculous, like QAnon and whatnot, I think the deep state is actually a really useful concept. And I think there is a deep state. There is an entrenched bureaucracy in D.C. A lot of the people that are in the CIA, you know, they're not rotated out when there's a new president.
I get this experience all the time again as an environmental lawyer when the bureaucrats believe in the program that they're administering, and they take ownership to it, and they object to changes, and they will resist. And the irony is that the deep state used to be something that the liberals would complain about being, you know, and then once Trump became president, suddenly the deep state became something that to be applauded because they were resisting Trump's initiatives.
Yeah, right? Do you remember, just real briefly, I think there was a really famous, I think it was a Bill Moyers documentary back in the 80s called, I think it was called The Shadow Government, and it dealt with Oliver North and all that Rex 84 stuff. So yeah, it was a liberal issue.
Yes. And then it got flipped when suddenly they started resisting some of Trump's initiatives, and now suddenly they became the liberal press now suddenly was applauding the deep state. Oh, they're not deep state. They're just the loyal, everyday, patriotic Americans who are trying to prevent this lawless president from taking his country in the wrong direction. It's all about your perspective, but there's no doubt that there is a permanent government in place. And I tell you, as an environmental lawyer, I continue to be surprised at how much my experience is informing me about what is going on. And I can see when they just don't want to follow policy, there's so many ways they could slow things down and just not agree. And you have to force them to do it. And their view is this guy's a temporary occupant. We'll just wait him out for 4 years.
And you know what? And I have to be honest, I don't think in any way that means, I'm a Trumpist now, because I say,
My point. My point was that at one point, the liberals were complaining about it. And then now the conservatives, when Trump was in power, they were complaining about it. So it's when both sides complain, there's some truth there about this resistant bureaucratic body that I think our founders would have. And the problem is the way our court system, we have this thing called Chevron deference, where the courts will basically defer to the administrative agencies that have been given power by Congress. And there is a concept that for two cases in the mid-30s, the court said that Congress is the lawmaker, the administrative, the deep state is part of the executive branch. They can only do what Congress delegates them to do. And this is getting way wonky, but I just want to say that there is a current debate in this country about whether this administrative state is engaging in illegal lawmaking with all the regulations, everything they pass. And yet the courts will not, there's been several attempts to rein this in the last 10 years. And again, mainstream, they're afraid to touch this. We don't have enough people on the Supreme Court to reverse this. But this administrative state has gotten out of control. And they think they're the ones that make the law now. And Congress doesn't do anything. They've delegated these broad swaths of power. I'm probably preaching to the choir here, Jacob, right? But I mean, I'm not necessarily a quote unquote libertarian, but I am very, as an environmental lawyer, I see these broad swaths of power being given to agencies who then feel they're empowered to do stuff because they know the courts are not going to take a hard look at them.
I was going to just add to that. I mean, I think one of the biggest examples of that for me is related to the war on terror. I mean, we have the 2001 authorization of use of military force, and libertarians have been very good on that because, you know, that AUMF, it was so broad. You know, I don't even think it mentioned Afghanistan directly, that it just gives massive power to, you know, what I would call the war state. Jacob, do you want to comment on that?
And look at what that did. You can't go anywhere now in the cities without getting a picture taken. Right, Jacob? I mean, they took that power and they have basically violated the Fourth Amendment, in essence. I mean, we have such an intrusive government right now that, and now I'm saying it and I'm sounding like one of Jacob's supporters, you know?
That's that, okay.
They took this law and remember, and again, who are these bureaucrats? They're flawed human beings. They're not perfect people. And you give them power, they'll use it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, we're living under omnipotent government. I mean, we're living under omnipotent government. This is a government it's the surveillance state, spying on us, watching what we're doing on the internet, who we're writing to. We've got a government that has the power to assassinate us, to torture us, to indefinitely detain us. This has all come with the war on terrorism, which is an outgrowth of foreign interventionism, which is morphed out of the Cold War, the war on communism. I mean, there's just a straight line through all of this stuff. And who benefits from this? The deep state, the national security state, the Pentagon, the CIA. Look at their budgets. Look at the amount of money flooding in there. Even today, with Afghanistan over, they're asking for more money. It's incredible.
And this is also percolating through other parts of our society, this whole culture cancer. I mean, this cancel culture. What did we fight the Cold War for freedom? And yet we are now having people advocating to cancel speech, to have people lose their jobs for thinking something that the rest of the people don't agree. I mean, there are times when I feel that my neighbors are doing what the Stasi asked the East Germans to do. It's rat on your neighbors. Tell them that they're not wearing a mask. I mean, I sometimes ask myself, did the communist win? Because when you look at some of the things in our country, and I'm an independent voter. I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat. I support Jacob because a lot of things I agree with him on. But when I look at what's going, and this is all an outgrowth of what's happened. This government has gotten so big. And it's okay to like, there are law school professors being fired for saying things like, I'm concerned that this certain group of people are at the bottom of my class. And I don't know what to do about to get their grades better. And they get fired because that group's association complains to the dean. You can't even like talk in good faith anymore. So, but this is all an outgrowth of what happened in 1963. Just the some of this stuff is more tangential, but we're going in a direction, this huge government, that it's controlling. It is, I feel like it's 1984.
No, that's what Kennedy was threatening.
Yeah,
that's what he was threatening.
Yes.
I was just going to add to that, that's a really good point, Leary. I mean, I'm supportive of doing whatever we can to combat COVID. And I'm, you know, I wear the mask outside, you know, or when I go to places. But at the same time, and I will probably catch flack for this, there are people that are very resistant to that. And I'm not like, oh, we should just we should just not talk to these people. We should, just exile them from society. I don't know how you can do that without.
AJ, it's worse than that. They want the government to order people to get shots. That is the most basic of freedom, of not to have someone inject something in your body, is the very premise of liberty. And they are going because of the circumstances. And that goes back to what Jacob said. You give anyone the right circumstances. My pastor once said, you give anybody the right circumstances, they can commit murder. And it's these people that probably felt in 1963, the circumstances were right, that there was a threat to the country and you had to commit murder. But what they're doing now, yes, does it seem like it's the right, is a good reason for it? But the principle is you can't be injecting people with something they don't want. That is what the very essence of liberty is. And the Fourth Amendment, right, to be free, to not to be unreasonable search and seizure. So anyway, we've really gone far, but you can see how the Kennedy assassination, the seeds of what, and that's what's important for your generation to realize. Because you guys are the ones, Jacob and I, we're at the end of our professional careers, towards the end, right? The fight is going to be carried on by your generation. And they have to understand that the Kennedy assassination is not a purely historical event. Yes, it happened almost 60 years ago. But the forces that were put into play are in play now. And you guys have to step up and see what's going on. And it may be, when you look at, a narrow picture, oh, you know what? It makes sense to make people have to get a vaccine. But what is that doing to the Constitution? That is just as much of a threat to the Constitution, because today it's for a good reason. Tomorrow could be for a bad reason.
Well, and don't forget also that the way they're provoking crises around the world, your generation faces the draft, including girls now, women. That they will be drafting women, and you're going to get hit with a real big reality check, possibly, that when you get a draft notice that you're going to go to Korea to fight or kill or be killed, all of a sudden your generation is going to wake up and say, now we see what Larry and Jacob have been talking about. When you're over there at a training camp and being sent to Korea in a couple of months to die on the fields of Korea. I mean, this is a very real issue that is relevant, not just in 1963, it is relevant today under this national security establishment.
I even think it's relevant. I always tell people, in a way, in a way, we have a poverty draft in this country. I mean, I know kids from dead end towns in Pennsylvania, where I'm at, that they go into the military because they see it as the only way out, and that's one of the reasons I'm opposed to these wars.
As long as the 1% is paying the price, the upper 1% doesn't care.
That's right.
Jacob, do you still remember your draft number?
Yeah, 77.
I had 69. I thought I was going in with that.
Well, it's funny. I always tell people, it seems like these people like Robert Kagan, who were, very upset about, oh, we're losing our position as the dominant superpower. They're willing to fight with every last drop of blood shed by everyone except them and their kids.
Of course. That's the way the system works. It's always worked that way. Like in Vietnam.
Right.
It was the poor kids that got sent over there.
It's when they got rid of the college deferment is when they decided to get rid of the war.
That's right. Because the well-to-do kids started protesting.
Right. I have to say, though, in some weird way, I don't know what you think about this, Jacob. I'm just off the top of my head here. This is really off.
Uh-oh.
But in some weird way, at least when you had a draft, you had different strata of life. Were oftentimes, remember those World War II movies? They had the Irish kid, the Italian kid, the WASP. They had the black or Latin person. They all got together and got to know each other. So in that respect, maybe in the year of national service instead of military service, but I would still like to see, but that's way off the topic.
I would say it's never right to have involuntary servitude. And right. That what we need to do is end these wars, end the interventions, dismantle the national security state, and put in a limited government republic.
So I just had a closing comment I wanted to make. And then, Larry, I wanted to give you a chance to let listeners know how they can support your efforts.
Yes.
For me, closing comment on all of this, I want to get back to the transparency thing and say, you know, we mentioned the vaccine issue. And I actually am supportive of the vaccination efforts. But, you know, people will complain. I heard people on NPR complaining and lamenting, there are Black Americans that don't want to take the vaccine. I'm thinking to myself, well, you haven't engendered much trust in Black America with what we did with Tuskegee and yes. those experiments. And you know what? If we want our institutions to work, they have to gain the trust of the people back because they somehow lost it in the first place. And that's an institutional failure. That's an elite failure. And to me, the reason these records need to be released is to do just a little thing to at least gain a little bit of trust back for our institutions. And we can't do it unless we have transparency. That this is really important, this issue of the JFK records, in my opinion, for that reason, because it would show goodwill that maybe our institutions could start trying to gain back their trust. And I know Jacob's a lot more cynical about that, and I get why, but, you know, there needs to be a good faith effort made.
Well, you know, they make a big thing about having diverse cabinets and, you know, it's all about symbolism. We need a big symbol right now. And I think one step in the right direction would be to at least release the records and let the chips fall where they may. But for your listeners or viewers, I'm not quite sure what you have. We would like, if you agree that the record should be released, please call the White House. The White House switchboard is 202-456-1414. They actually have a comments phone number as well, and that's 202-456-1111. You don't have to be a citizen of the United States. You can call as often as you want. It isn't like voting. and of course, if you want to send a letter, the White House is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C., 20500. So if you believe that the record should be released, we have to try to repeat what happened in 1991 after the Oliver Stone movie. So please call the White House, call your congressperson and senator as well. Ask them to support this as well. And maybe we'll be able to do what happened in 91 and maybe finish the job, because the job wasn't finished when the ARC went out of business. They had a power that they had power to overrule the agencies, and that power disappeared with the ARC. All the National Archives can do is cooperate with the agency and give the president the recommendation. The president's the only one right now that can overrule the agencies. And we want him to overrule them and release everything, unless there is the remote isolated record that truly, that Jacob and I cannot figure out how it possibly can. But if there's truly a record that the president believes is entitled to be classified still, he has to explain that to us. Document by document, explain why this document is entitled to be further classified, as opposed to just saying, I'm letting the next 2,000-3,000 documents get postponed. But please call the White House and ask to have the records released.
I'll just say, I agree 110%. And it's time for the government to serve the people rather than people serving the government. Jacob, how can my listeners keep up with your work?
Well, let me just address briefly the vaccine issue and the masks and so forth. I mean, I agree with Larry. Free society, I'm a libertarian. Free society is one where the government's not mandating anything like that to people. But I'd go even further. I'd say, get government out of the healthcare business. Just let the private industry handle the healthcare problem. Let's look to the healthcare professionals for leadership instead of politicians and bureaucrats. Now, JG, you keep suggesting that transparency will restore trust in government and so forth. And I understand your point, but if you assume for a second, like I assume, that these records will further fortify that this was a regime change operation, I'm not sure that people are going to have much trust in the CIA when they realize that, hey, I mean, that's why they got to keep these records secret. They know what would happen if more and more people figure out this thing was a regime change operation. They have no choice. That's why I think the fix is in. They've kept these records secret for over 50 years. Don't you think that if it's in because it's incriminating, they're going to have to keep them secret for another 5 years, 10 years? They can't ever release these records because of the incriminating nature. If people see, for example, what was going on in New Orleans and Mexico City, and they realize that this was all part of an operation being run by the CIA and the military, that's not going to restore faith in the Pentagon and the CIA. It's going to do the exact opposite. That's why they have to keep these things secret.
And how can my listeners keep up with what you're doing at the Future of Freedom Foundation?
Well, we have a daily email updates called FFF Daily, and we strive to make it the best libertarian commentary page on the internet. Now,
it's fabulous. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know this that many of your listeners may not be libertarians, but we address all sorts of things where people would probably agree with us. Like Larry wouldn't describe himself as a libertarian, but he subscribes to our stuff because he knows what we write on the Kennedy assassination, on the national security state.
I just wanted to add to that really briefly. I saw that you had an article from Lawrence Vance about Afghanistan and how, you know, conservatives may not want to do it right now, but, you know, Bush and Trump also have to take responsibility. So I feel like libertarians can often coalesce with various different political tribes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we've called for drug legalization for 31 years at FFF, which is a leftist position, and conservatives hate the idea. By the same token, we're strongly in favor of free markets. We want to open the borders, for example. Well, conservatives hate that position. Well, so do liberals, I guess. But what I'm saying is that we cause people to think. We challenge their paradigm. And we don't expect people to agree with us on everything. We don't seek agreement. We seek thinking. That's what we're looking for, is thinking people. And that's, so we've got the FFF Daily to subscribe to. We've got a monthly journal called Future of Freedom that's by a subscription fee, $25 a year or $15 for the email version. And if you like our work, we rely on donations. We welcome your support. We're running a great civil liberties conference starting this month. On September 14th, we're going to run a weekly series of talks. Instead of having a two-day conference where you got to sit there on Zoom and watch 2 days worth of conferences, we're going to have a lecture every week, every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on restoring civil liberties to our land. And I know that Larry would be totally sympathetic and on board with that concept. We got an all-star cast of lawyers and other people that are going to be talking about what we need to do to restore civil liberties to America.
And I'll tell you what Jacob's doing is showing us the way it used to be, where you don't go off into your tribes. You actually find areas that you can agree on. You know, I have lots of liberal friends who were shocked that they were going to Jacob's seminar on the Kennedy assassination. They could not believe about Jacob's views and the people they said, how could this libertarian believe in this stuff? And it was eye-opening and mind-opening to them. And that's the way we used to be. We used to find the things we could agree on. You disagree on what you disagree on, but you try to find the things you can agree on. And Jake has provided a valuable service to a lot of people who were, they loved John Kennedy. They were very strong liberals. They thought every conservative was a lone nut person, right? And then Jacob comes along with these, and they're like, wow. And that sort of helped when I proposed to have a bipartisan signatory list. Because of Jacob, they were okay with that, because they realized that there are people on both sides that, you know, we can coalesce together.
Well, but the thing is, you know, and this is the ultimate point, and this is why I have a lot of libertarians on my show, including Jacob, including Jim Bovard, including Scott Horton. You know, we may disagree on, you know, I'm kind of a Bernie Sanders kind of guy. So on healthcare, we probably have major disagreements, but politics is about building coalitions. Yes. And working with people from different, you know, sort of political viewpoints and coming together on the issues that we all agree on. Because if we don't have coalitions, then, you know, we'll never get anywhere with these issues.
I mean, I support Jacob because I what he's doing, this, what he's doing to help, you know, I am supporting his effort. I don't agree with everything he stands for, his group stands for, but there's enough good stuff there that we can coalesce around, and I'm supporting him.
And Jacob, I know, probably disagrees with us on a lot of things.
Well, it's a big honor to get support from somebody like Larry, because I hold him in the highest esteem for the work that he's doing. It takes a lot of courage to take this stand on the Kennedy assassination. You get ostracized by people. You get the smearing, the conspiracy theorists and all that nonsense. And Larry's leading the charge. I mean, this letter he wrote, we published it at the Future of Freedom Foundation that he wrote to the president. We're trying to bring a lot of publicity to this. And so it's an honor that when Larry became a donor to FFF, and we don't disclose our donors, but since Larry has said it, I feel very comfortable in saying, thank you, Larry. We're very appreciative for that.
I think you do great work, and I'm, you know, I want to continue to see you do this work. We've covered a lot of topics on this, on this talk tonight that probably you didn't anticipate, but again, this goes to how the Kennedy assassination is still relevant today. Everything we talked about all emanated from our connections with the Kennedy assassination and where this country has gone since then.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank both of you, Larry and Jacob, for coming on Parallax Views.
Oh, thank you. This has been a real pleasure. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. So yeah. Thank you very much for having us.
We're gonna have problems editing this.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Larry Schnapp and Jacob Hornberger. As always, if you can, please, 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 please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Hard at work on releasing some new bonus content for $5 tier and up supporters. And of course, there's also a producer's credit you can get if you support me at the $10 or $15 tiers. So that brings us to the producer's credit shoutouts to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, Emilia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, consider joining those listeners and supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is everything from a $1 to a $100 tier. At the $100 tier, you are a very, 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 very important person. You're an angel donor, basically, to this show. But I'm not expecting many people to join that tier. In any case, I added that tier recently, and you are an angel donor if you join at that tier. But ultimately, I really am pushing the most for the $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers of my Patreon page at, again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.